Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. Tonight, our topic is the mini-series Tanner 88. Tonight's going to be a little bit of a different episode, as a few weeks ago we had an episode on director Robert Altman scheduled, and somehow, while the show was going on, Blog Talk shifted us to only having 15 minutes of broadcast time, which meant we then had an hour of extra time, and we got our questions in. It was a good show, but there were still a few questions that we didn't get to. There were some topics that we didn't get to, including much discussion of his television work, and so tonight's episode has come about as a way of letting us discuss that, of having room for television discussion and having room to breathe. And also, Carl wasn't able to join us last time, but tonight Carl is here. So say hello, Carl.
Hello, Carl.
Yep, and he will be getting the special honor of getting a rundown of the questions we asked last time. But also joining me are Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
And Patrick Crane. Say hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Patrick!
So,
Aaron!
Okay, I'm done.
Yes. So, you know, we're gonna begin this with the TV discussion. Now, you know, I have to ask this question, and, you know, Altman did a lot of television. You know, most people just think of Tanner, Gunn, and sometimes Vincent and Theo. But he did a lot of work earlier in his career, and he did work throughout the 80s and 90s that you usually don't hear about. Now, we're not going to get to that too much tonight, but I do want to focus on Tanner and Vincent and Theo and a few other things. But as such, I'll begin with you, Patrick. Do you find that Altman's TV work differs at all from his theatrical work?
Well, in terms of his, like, network television work that we're talking, if you're talking about the post-delinquents and James Dean story, the pre-Countdown, I've only ever seen, I think, his one Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode. And, you know, all of that stuff is very, I think, you know, very workmanlike in what it's trying to do. And I think that he was just working in the system until he got his next big break with Countdown in 1968, I believe it was. But
yeah,
if you're extending that to stuff like the stuff that he did in the 80s and the television movies, then you can see, I mean, obviously by the time you get to that, there's a lot of it. But as far as his network television work is concerned, I haven't seen enough of it to make a judgment on that. But what I have seen of it, it feels like, you know, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, most of them, except if they're directed by Alfred Hitchcock, all seem to be kind of interchangeable.
Yeah. And now you know, like especially now his more of his cable stuff, like well, tonight's topic, which is Tanner, but also stuff like Vincent and Theo, how do you feel those compare to his regular output?
Because
I think they're pretty much of a piece.
I think the Tanner pieces and Vincent and Theo are very much part of his canon, almost in a way that the Kane Mutiny Court Martial isn't. Even though it's a great made-for-television film and it's a fine piece by Robert Altman, but Tanner 88 has a life beyond itself, and it's seeped into other people's work now. And
yeah.
Vincent and Theo, You know, it's nominally a television show. I mean, it was a BBC series, but you know, it plays much like an Altman film. I mean, it's very busy and it's very, there's a lot of very interesting themes in Vincent and Theo that I was really struck by. But I definitely,
it's amazing what that extra half hour, 40 minutes does to change it when you see the miniseries version.
Oh, right. And you know what? I've never watched the theatrical version. I've owned it forever, but then once I went region free, I went over to Amazon UK, and I was like, hell yeah, I'm going to buy this whole thing and watch it like I'm supposed to watch it. And that's the only way I've ever seen it. I think they cut an entire hour out of that thing for the theatrical version. So I'd be interested. I have it. I've just never watched it.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you said about, you know, never looking back once you went region free. Aaron and I have talked about this before, but how is it you put it, put your, how, what is it that you say about region coding, Aaron?
Oh, I'm pretty, I feel like it's a violation of free speech, really. I feel like they're taking people's words out of their mouth and then making you go overseas or illegally go. Like, most region free players are technically illegal because the studios don't want us seeing what they're only releasing in Japan or in Europe, or depending on how far you break this system down, like DVD with 6 regions versus Blu-rays 3. Thankfully, we're moving out of that, I think. Most Blu-rays now are coded region 3, thank God. But
and surprisingly,
it's
most Disney.
Still a mess. Yeah, Disney led the way on that, actually. Criterion is now starting to do it too, but not on all of their releases. But like their Agnes Varda set was ABC.
Yeah. Well, that enough of that. What about you, Carl? What do you see as the differences or the similarities between Altman's theatrical and TV output?
Well, I think I have to preface this in terms that I know I've seen his TV work on Combat, particularly because my father watched every damn episode and that. But I didn't realize a lot of his TV work until post Countdown. But one of the things I will have to say about his TV work, as opposed to his theatrical work, is that particularly if he's given a certain runtime, you know, then things are compacted into that runtime. So the pacing of his TV work is more compact and it moves quicker. And one of the best ways to see that is if you ever see the theatrical version of his craft theater thing, Nightmare in Chicago, which is just, it's unreal how good that is and how compact and how it moves and how actually he's really good with action. I mean, he could do so many things, but I think the main thing that I see is pacing. That he tends to be a little more leisurely in his, particularly his camera work, and his editing in his films. That's not so much the case in his TV work.
Yeah, that's actually something I would agree with. And, you know, it's interesting, you use the word leisurely, and one of my favorite filmmakers is Mike Lee, and I've always described his work as leisurely. But whereas Altman picks up the pace on TV, Mike Lee just takes his time no matter what.
Right. And I think it's also that's also representative of, you have an American filmmaker and a British filmmaker, and British TV is a lot different than American TV.
Oh, yeah, Oh, yeah. Okay. But European TV in general is, I mean, you know, I can't think of many, you know, U.S. outlets that would have somebody like Edgar Wright's come to them and say, well, you know, I have this idea for a 16-hour miniseries, and if it's successful, I think the next one will be about 20 or 30 hours, and the next one after that will be about another 12 to 20 hours. Are you in for this? It'll take about 20 years to make this. Oh, sure. No, I don't think NBC or even HBO would go for that shit.
Thank God for the BBC. Okay.
Absolutely. So finally to you, Aaron, what are your thoughts on this topic?
The pre-countdown stuff. I think Patrick used the word workman, and I think that pretty much nails it. What do you do, 14 episodes of Bonanza?
Yeah.
Well, he did a lot of eight. He did a lot of Westerns.
And,
given that's what was on TV at that point.
Whirlybirds, right?
He did 14 episodes of something. 20 episodes of Whirlybirds, 13 episodes of The Millionaire. 10 of Bonanza.
Yeah.
His work doesn't really... The shows had their formula, and, you know, everybody who directed for them was stuck in it, which is fine. That's what they were. But his TV work after he became, you know, Robert Altman, I think is all of a piece with his filmic work. I think once he was able to find his voice, or rather be allowed to use his voice, that he never really gave it up again. Like, even Delinquents, which is his theatrical debut, is not his movie. He played with the genre a little bit, but it was very much a director for hire thing. And so really, Countdown, and then especially That Cold Day in the Park, is where he really started to be able to express himself as himself. I don't think he ever gave that back after that. I think everything he made after Countdown was his, and very much so, for the better or worse.
Yep. So, Carl, you'll get the honor of starting this next one. So, in terms of Tanner 88, do you think this is more Altman or more Gary Trudeau, or do you think it's really a good partnership?
I think it's a good partnership, but basically Altman basically ate Trudeau for lunch. Seriously, that is so Altman, it's not even funny. And granted, Trudeau, you know, set things up and there's some really good dialogue. But to me, it's so naturalistic that it's almost just like any Altman film where people are riffing and doing things off the cuff and not on the script. And so on and so forth, and then you've got the camera work, and we'll get more into that. But also the use of music, which is incredible in that series, and it's very
which
under
is
the
part
radar.
Of why I took a long time for it to get on DVD.
It's Altman. Altman ate Trudeau for lunch. Seriously.
Well, Aaron, what do you have to say to that?
I can't say I disagree. I do think it was a very good working relationship. Obviously, they came back almost 20 years later for the sequel with the whole creative team back intact. Altman said it was the most fun he ever had on a shoot because it was just so chaotic.
because they were letting that week's headlines basically dictate how they were doing it. And from that perspective, it is more of a director's series than a writer's series because it has to be so up to date
that they have to improvise more.
But it is very much like Trudeau's court. Like, Trudeau invited Robert Altman to play basketball with him. So I think it was a very good marriage, but I do think ultimately that Altman does steal the show behind the scenes. Of course, Michael Murphy steals the show in totality.
He was very good, you know. I have to say, the first time that I saw Tanner, I wasn't sure he was going to work out, but he pretty quickly establishes himself. You know, it takes pretty much the whole first fucking episode, but then you're like, okay, yeah, this guy's going to do it.
Yeah.
So, Patrick.
Well, I think that... Okay, go ahead, guys. Hold on.
No, well, actually, you know what? Go ahead and add in what you were going to say, Carl, and then we'll go to Patrick.
The thing about it is Michael Murphy, I just wanted to make a point that he worked originally with Altman on a couple of combat series, 63. So they've known each other for years. And Altman has this repertory of actors, and if Altman says this actor can do it, there's no question. This actor can do it. Whether or not he does is a different question. You know.
Yeah.
But in the case of Murphy, I think he's one of the most underrated actors of that era of all time. I mean, seriously, he's so good.
Oh, he's very good. He's very good, you know, and especially here. You know, yeah, he gets the big scenes, but there's also a lot of subtle work that I don't think gets the attention it deserves.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He's much more of a subtle actor. Agreed.
So Patrick, what about you? How do you feel on this?
Yeah, I think this one's a great match. I think that it's much more in the end an Altman piece, just because of everything that's been mentioned, the kind of the chaotic nature of it, and it really does feel so Altman-esque. But I would also say that I don't know if Tanner would have the kind of legs that it does if not for the, you know, political exactitude, you know, in the details, and that's all Trudeau.
Yeah.
And I actually do have some insight into this. I grew up in politics. My dad was the executive director of the Democratic Party in Oklahoma in the late 70s, and he worked on many, many campaigns and gubernatorial campaigns and governors, and so I always tagged along and was kind of part of that world. And Tanner 88, one of the reasons I love it so much also is because I have seen those people. I mean, those people are really real, and that campaign feels really real from the top to the bottom. And that, I believe, all comes from Gary Trudeau. And you can see the kind of comparison in the way that Altman treats politics, say, in Nashville, which also has Michael Murphy as a political figure in that, which is more broad and cartoony, although it works and it feels real in that particular context, versus Tanner that has to be real because it actually is incorporating real people. But it is I think it has the legs that it does because of that level of realism. But I think that it achieves a certain kind of place in history because of Altman's expertise. I mean, after all, you know, Soderbergh did this same very thing with K Street in 2004, and nobody talks about that damn thing. And even though it's great, but nobody talks about it, and he did the exact same thing.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. I think that's something that's interesting about Tanner is, it was so rooted in the headlines that there's a lot of little stuff that gets lost now, you know. Maybe even somebody like myself who's pretty good on history and particularly 20th century political history, there are a few moments in Tannerite where I went, okay, yeah, that's who that is, and that's who this is. It took me a minute, whereas, you know, when you were watching it in 88, you knew exactly who the hell it was. And, it took on a different significance when it was airing than it does now. But as a time capsule, it's quite something to behold. And the fact that they made it work at all under the conditions that they were working, I think, is pretty extraordinary.
Oh, agreed. Agreed.
Absolutely. So, Aaron, do we have a favorite and least favorite aspect of Tanner?
My favorite aspect is that just how they did it. The fact that they took this actor and this group of actors and threw him literally into a real presidential campaign. My absolute favorite moment in this series, though, is the debate. Where they edited Michael Murphy as Jack Tanner's responses to the other candidates. Obviously, they can't throw a fictional character onto a presidential debate stage. So they had it staged in such a way that it looked like he was on stage with them, and then they just showed us the TV monitors as he was giving the responses, and it was just so brilliant the way that they did that, to get it out so quickly after the night of the actual debate. Least favorite part. I have very few complaints. I think that Alex can be a little grating at times, but she's supposed to be. So I can't really fault the series with that so much as just a character who is a 20-year-old girl trying to help her dad on a campaign that she's in over her head with. She's supposed to be grating, but she does grate on me, so.
Yeah, you know, I have to say,
especially in the wedding episode.
Yeah, the wedding episode, but I have to say, I'm with you on Cynthia Nixon as Alex. I've just never been a big Cynthia Nixon fan, and nothing she's ever done, including Tanner on Tanner, which we'll get to. I think Tanner on Tanner, I'll save that for later, but I think Cynthia Nixon was mostly a hindrance to that series. Yeah, so, Patrick, your thoughts on this?
I think my favorite thing about Tanner, I mean, you know, it was already said that, you know, that it really kind of exists at all. It's just such a genius piece of television and just such a great comment on politics and the media, and it's such a great time capsule. I also love that it showed that Robert Altman deliver, a truly monumental piece of work at a time where he was sort of counted out and not really much considered anymore. And he did it.
Yeah, people were sort of ignoring
the table. What?
I said people were really starting to ignore him in the 80s.
Oh, no, he was he was in exile in the 80s. I mean, he did his little bitty project. The only studio thing he got was Ocean Stiggs, really. You know, he fiddled around. The entire 80s was kind of a wasteland for him. But here he comes with, like, one of his greatest things he's ever made in the 80s, and he does it on a premium cable network, which is now something that everybody does. You know, I mean, so he was, again, way ahead of the curve. That's one of the things I really, really do like about it. And I think it's just an expert piece of filmmaking. Another one of these things in Robert Altman's filmography that is made with such a great observational flair. My least favorite thing about it, it might be Cynthia Nixon, though I'm not as down on her on this as we will, of course, talk about in Tanner 88 or Tanner on Tanner. I'll tell you what. One thing it just bugs me, and it's not even that big of a deal. The Billy Tidrow character, played by Harry Anderson, that's a fascinating person. That's an actual real political person that goes in and does these kinds of things where they whip delegates and get all these and make all this stuff happen behind the scenes. It's a frantic thing. Yep. It's a real role, but I think that it's treated too broadly for whatever reason. And whenever I see it, it bothers me when he puts on his shoes and the soda that blows up and all this kind of stuff. It just, I don't know, whatever reason that bothers me whenever I see it. I don't know why, but you know, Tanner 88 is one of these things I rank 5 stars on Letterboxd and find very little fault with. So, I mean, that's my biggest quibble with it, I guess.
Yeah. No. It's interesting that you mentioned that character because, you know, I don't think there's anything exactly wrong with the character. But for me, you know, yeah, it was a little broad, but I wanted to see more. And I think it might have been interesting to get a little more shading perhaps in the episode before because it was obvious that they were going to go this route. And had we gotten some sort of an inkling of that character coming, I think the character might have worked even better than it does.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And I got to say, one thing that I do love about it is the early episode when they're at the one of their early stops where they go to the people's house and they're supposed to be a remote there and they're not and they're stuck there with these people and it turns out that all they really are political starfuckers who like to collect autographs. But I like that, you know, these are the salt of the earth people that, you know, we really, you know, remotes always go to their houses and they're always, you know, these are the people that really elect the president of the United States. And it turns out that they're just as phony and cynical as everything else. I love that. And I love that that sentiment is being pushed in 1988.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So finally, Carl, what about you?
Well, as far as the best elements of Tanner, I think, you know, of course, we've talked about Michael Murphy. The use of music, I think, is really it varies from very subtle to hit you over the head with the hammer, and he does it all throughout the episodes. And it is amazing how much music, and you've got to realize, of course, how much he loved music, Altman. I mean, so many of his films center around music.
Look at McCabe and Miss Miller.
You know, Kansas City, A Perfect Couple, even. You know, I mean, many of them deal with music.
Kansas City is so underrated.
I think that's wonderful,
love that.
And I think I need to say something else too here as far as my favorite things. Whatever happened to Pamela Reed? Because she is fucking unreal on this show. She is so good.
Amen. Amen, Carl. She's awesome in this. And I amen. Like that's another, her character's so great too.
Yes.
Yeah, and the thing is, what else do we know her from? Kindergarten Cop. That's it.
Yeah.
That woman is a hell of an actress. And I, you know, that is a testament to her work. Her work in that series is stellar. Now, as far as on the opposite side, yeah, I think I'm getting on to Cynthia Nixon. She's just, yeah. And I'll tell you something else. So who is the woman that I can't, you know, she's sort of like a ditz, and she's auburn hair, brown hair.
The rich girl that sets everything up out in L.A. Yep, her.
Yeah, her. She's, again, I think maybe that's my biggest problem is that the women tend to be a little more one-dimensional, with the exception of Pamela Reed. And, of course, if you got Pamela Reed just killing it, it's kind of hard to keep up with her.
And honestly, I was just looking up Pamela Reed, and the thing is she's apparently had a shit ton of
she's been on The Simpsons since 92.
Yeah, she's had a shit ton of recurring roles. Apparently, she has a long-term role on NCIS as one of the characters' mothers. She was on Parks and Rec. She's done a lot of movies. So, you know, the thing is she's kept busy, but it's never been major work.
Well, and I don't think that we usually talk about women when we talk about character actors, which is what she is.
Yeah, and she's a very fine one, you know. I do think Carl has a point about the way the show treated the women, but... You know, that we should get into that. That's actually odd, being that Altman is usually so good with women. You know, the women come off in his films so well, whereas the women here, I don't know. The women, for me, ended up being the least interesting characters, and that's disappointing in an Altman film or an Altman work. You know, you go in kind of expecting it, and then it's not. But I mean, that doesn't mean that I'm not gonna, you know, that I'm not a huge fan of this, that I wouldn't give it like 4.5 stars, but I do think that it's something to note as a little bit of an anomaly, and I wonder if that's not down to Trudeau more than Altman
or just the speed and soft actor personalities coming through more.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, and I'd note that I think that the Andrea character has an interesting arc, at least. I mean, she starts off as the ditzy girl, but she gets her shit together, and then she starts bossing people around. She becomes an interesting character to me, at least. And, you know, then I think T.J. Kavanaugh is an incredibly interesting character.
Yeah, and she ends up being pretty interesting in Tanner on Tanner as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's not a whole lot of... You know, Jack's girlfriend, I think, is not very interesting. But you know, the women on the campaign, you know, Alex, very much her age aside, you know, I don't know, TJ and Andrea, I think, are fun foils for each other, and they each have really good moments and whatnot. I find them interesting enough.
Yep. So now we come to the sequel, and I'll go with you, Patrick. This is a two-part question. How well does Tanner on Tanner hold up, and does the sequel complement the original, or is it kind of pointless?
I struggled to find, you know, a real need for it when I watched it just recently. I don't necessarily think it complements Tanner 88 really all that well. It doesn't because Jack Tanner becomes a supporting character in it. This is a Tanner 88 is about Alex Tanner, Tanner on Tanner is about Alex Tanner, not Jack Tanner really. He's a supporting character in this. I think that it's an interesting bookend because the first one is the, you know, election of a President Bush, and this one is about basically another, you know, this is heading into a reelection of his son, for you know, and so I think there's a there's an interesting thing there, but I ultimately think that it really feels more like it's riding on the popularity of Cynthia Nixon, more than it does really anything to do with Robert Altman or Tanner 88, because I just feel that it's, you know, I feel it's a weaker Altman piece, and you know, I could have probably just done without it entirely.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. that's fair enough. I feel similar. I mean, you know, it took me about half the series to go, okay, this doesn't completely stink, and I guess, you know, there might be a reason. I guess I see what Altman and Trudeau are trying to do, even though I think what they were trying to do got muddled, and muddled basically because Cynthia Nixon is, for me, a very hard performer to watch. There's something dead inside her that I don't think works when you're an actor. I'll just say it. My girlfriend's been watching the Sex and the City sequel, which she calls a train wreck, but she can't pull her eyes away from it. And wouldn't you know it, next to Sarah Jessica Parker being the worst thing about it, the second worst thing is, Cynthia Nixon. That doesn't surprise me at all because she was always the weakest link on the original series, as much as I dislike Parker, but I actually did enjoy the original Sex and the City, but I watched it for Samantha was was a great character, and Kim Cattrall was absolutely amazing in that role. But that's talk for another episode. So, Carl, what about you? How do you feel about this? How do you want to answer this two-part question?
Well, this is very easy. I've never seen it.
Whoa.
I didn't get a chance. I've never seen it. So you can move on from there.
Wow.
I mean, it's one of the few that I haven't seen, okay? I mean, listen, if you want to, you know, shame me for it, at least I've seen six of his documentaries and his work in Kansas, which probably a lot of you have not. So there.
Yeah. But so, you know, we'll take a moment to do this because I know we touched on it a little earlier, but Carl, you've seen Vincent and Theo, correct?
Hold on, you two were talking over. Patrick, you go ahead. What were you saying?
Oh, it was Aaron. I said, do I get to have my say?
Yeah.
Sorry. I guess did I skip over you?
Yeah.
On this, I'm so sorry. Yep. Hey, guys, I was, ladies and gentlemen out there in listener land, I'm getting over being pretty sick. So if I'm a little befuddled here, I think that might be the end of brain fog. I'm so sorry about that, Aaron. Go on.
No problem. I think that it complements Tanner 88, and it was unnecessary. This is going to sound absurd, but I really think it's Robert Altman fan service. There were so many like great little cameos. The edition I have starts every episode, like talking about what was happening in the world. And so it was really interesting getting some of the
like backstage stuff and them talking about how like when they were at the DNC in 2004, they'd rush up to someone with a camera and the politician would have no idea who they were because Tanner 88 was so long ago that they'd kind of forgotten about it. But they're politicians, so they have to smile and they have to answer the question. And that's why there's so many confused but polite-looking politicians in the convention, because they had no idea what was going on. But really, I think ultimately they were just trying to graft Alex, the Cynthia Nixon character, onto John Kerry's daughter by making her a documentarian, which John Kerry's daughter was. And it's like, hey, let's ride the coattails of the presumptive nominee. Actually, he was the nominee because 2004 was kind of a landslide after Howard Dean won Iowa.
And then whooped and lost.
and then he gave a barbaric yawp, as Whitman would say, and the media moved on. Anyway, but I felt the whole time that they were just trying to graft her onto Kerry's daughter. And so I think there was a lot of that could have been done better. I do think that ultimately it's an interesting piece, but I do also think that it's unnecessary. But getting to see Obama's convention speech again was just priceless. So who
yeah.
cares?
Yeah, that's a wonderful
sure.
speech. But So I do want to get back to Carl. I do want to start with him for this next part, since we do have a little time to do this. Carl, you have seen Vincent and Theo, right?
Yes. Now, I've only seen the theatrical. I've not seen the miniseries.
Okay.
So there is an hour or so of footage I've never seen. But even in watching the theatrical, a couple of things really comes through is his work with actors. And Tim Roth in that is just phenomenal.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He's just phenomenal. And I feel bad that I haven't seen the miniseries because that's more Tim Roth to watch.
If you want to see a good Tim Roth, watch the one that he did with Alan Clark.
Oh, I have seen that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Made
okay, good. Yes.
You know, but what – it's not my favorite of his. There seems to be – he pulls back a little bit, I think, because he's talking about a historical character, and so there's not as much movement of the character and so on and so forth, not as much improv, but nonetheless it is beautifully shot, it is gorgeous, and it is well acted even in the theatrical cut. So I have very little complaint.
No, I will say I think it's among his top 10 or 12 efforts. I was very, very impressed. I had not seen the miniseries version, and I hadn't seen the theatrical version since, almost 30 years ago. And seeing the miniseries version a few months back when it was streaming, I was like, wait, they've got it? They've actually got it? Because, you know, you have to understand that's actually a pretty hard addition to find on this side of the pond. And I sat down, watched it one afternoon, and it was great. I mean, you know, the work with the actors, the slight blending at the opening with some documentary work, and the way that he, you know, Allman isn't necessarily known for being a someone who shoots landscapes, but he managed to do some really good scenic work here. And, you know, I think that should put paid to the notion that he's all about busy talking in closed spaces.
But the one thing I would say on that is that you might not think of landscapes with Altman, but you certainly think of cityscapes. And you certainly think that wherever it is, no matter where he's shooting, that locale is part of the ambiance, and he makes sure that it is, whether it's Southern California in The World Goodbye, or it's in New Hampshire in
okay,
Canada.
Everybody take a drink. Carl just mentioned Long Goodbye.
I'll get to that later when I get my questions that I didn't get for the last time. Okay, never mind.
But, yeah, now I know Patrick mentioned Vincent and Theo earlier, so I'll just ask Aaron. So, Aaron, did you get a chance to see the miniseries version or no?
Yes.
Okay, so what are your thoughts on it real quick?
I think it is stunning. We only did top five works when we discussed Altman a couple weeks back. It is in my top 10, however. I think that we all talked about it when Julian Schnabel shot At Eternity's Gate. And the way that all of his shots were like impressionistic shots, right? But we didn't talk about that with Altman because Altman doesn't have that kind of reputation. But Altman shot it the same way. Altman shot Vincent and Theo the same way that At Eternity's Gate was shot. Tim Roth was incredible. It's one of the best performances of one of the most unappreciated careers of the last 30 years, 40 years.
Yeah. It's been around a while.
Yeah. You forget that, like, he'd been around a while by the time he made this in 1990. The way he built up the relationship between the brothers, we all know how Vincent Van Gogh's story ends, and still yet somehow he finds a way to make it just shocking and haunting when you know what's coming. You've known what was coming from the moment it started, and yet when it happens, you can't believe it happened. It's one of the best. I hesitate to say favorite because of the subject, but one of the best Altman works, films, miniseries, TV works, whatever you want to call it. It's all of the above.
Yeah. Yeah. So now we come to the part of the show that is going to be a little different than what we usually do, because we usually don't just ask one guest a whole series of questions in a row. But we're going to do that tonight. We're going to ask Carl a bunch of questions that we didn't get to, or that we got to last time, so Carl's caught up. So, Carl, here is the first question I'm going to ask you. Do you find Altman an accessible filmmaker or no?
Extremely accessible. The reason for that is that I find Altman to be one of the most humanistic directors. So it is about technique, but it's more about how he treats the people in his films. And he's a beautiful example of seeing both the faults and the good parts of a person. And he just lets his camera stick with that character. And so I think it's very, very accessible. I think he's very accessible.
And is he someone you would have a budding cinephile study early on, or would you have them wait a while as they work through other directors?
Oh, no. This would be one of the first people I would do with that for the same exact reason. Because the technique is there, and certainly if you want to, and you get into the overlapping dialogue and you get into the moving camera and so on and so forth, but primarily his focus is on the people. And to me, that's a perfect entry point for anyone going into a cinematic studies.
So
that probably differs from other answers, but yeah, from what I feel.
So now here's a corollary. If you were trying to create an Altman fan, which film would you use as your introduction and why?
You really have to ask me this?
Well, I think I know the answer, but yeah.
It has to be The Long Goodbye. Has to be. Because it's my favorite fucking film of his. Let's be
honest.
Yes.
You were 16 years old. You saw it in the drive-in.
HBO. No, HBO. I saw it on HBO. And we had early HBO. We were a test market. And my story, the way I tell it, is that I grew up reading all this private eye stuff. And I always wanted to be a private eye. But I knew I couldn't because physically I couldn't do it. You know, I had some physical problems and so on and so forth. And I loved Marlowe. I loved Chandler. And I'd already read The Long Goodbye. And then I saw The Long Goodbye with Ellie Gould, and I said, oh, my God, that's me on screen. That's the way I would play that character. And so, yeah. To me, I think it's a great intro to Altman simply because there's humor, there's humanity, and then there's that ending, which isn't in the novel, of course. And it's just like, oh, my God, there's just so much in that film to unpack. And I think that's a perfect way to introduce because people will watch that film and they will connect it in one way or another, or they won't connect with it at all because they love Chandler too much and it's too much of a diversion from the actual character. But I think it's a beautiful film. And a wonderful way to introduce someone to Altman.
Yep. Now, I'm not going to ask you the first question I always ask because you've already answered that. I will ask you this next one. Does he have a singular theme across his films?
I think the use of the word theme, because people think of theme as, you know, political viewpoints or something like that, social viewpoints. I don't know if I would call it a theme. But again, I've said this a couple times already. The man's a humanistic director. He's interested in the human animal. And what makes up the good parts, the bad parts, everything in between, the foibles, the addictions, everything, and you know, even in his gay characters and that, he, you know, like Burt Remsen and that sort of thing, they're just people.
Yeah.
And I think really, if there's a theme, it's humanism. And I keep going back to that word. And that's what's always connected me with him. And I'll just mention this. There's another director who I feel very, very strongly about, too, about this, and that's Lindsay Anderson. They both are interested in the people and in the journey that these people take during the time you're with them in the film. And so that's what I would say to that.
Well, here is the next question. Which period of his career is your favorite?
Can I say every?
If you had to choose one, say the 60s and 70s, or say the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, which would it be? I think.
Well, let me put it this way. If I were going to go decade, of course, everyone's going to expect me to say the 70s. And that I understand completely, and I love his 70s output. But I think his most interesting output is the 80s. Because you went back to saying that, you know, that was when he was on the outs from Hollywood. Well, that is, I think, one of his most fertile periods. You know, let's not just talk about films and the TV he did. He did two Broadway plays. He did three operas, directed three operas. He did all sorts of stuff during the 80s. And his filmic output in the 80s, which was specifically plays more than anything else, with the exception of one which I will mention as his worst film, I find everything in the 80s really fascinating because it is so unusual because he did what he wanted to do. Not what the studios wanted to do. He did what he wanted to do, and it shows. Even now, Come Back to Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, by Ed Grassick. Not a great play, but by God, with Altman directing it in film, holy shit!
Now you mentioned your least favorite film. That was actually going to be one of the next two questions. So, which is your least favorite Altman?
Oh, this is easy, Patrick. I'm with you. Beyond Therapy sucks.
Oh God, Beyond Therapy is fucking painful. I wanted to turn it off after 5 minutes.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah, it's
the wrong choice.
Yeah, Carl, that's my I gotta say that's my second least favorite. My least favorite's A Perfect Couple, but yes, Beyond Therapy is terrible.
Now I will ask you this question, Carl.
Okay.
Where does he rank in your pantheon?
You need to ask that?
Is he your favorite, or do you actually have a second favorite? I mean, if you had to flip a coin, is it going to be Altman, or is it going to be Anderson?
It's going to be Altman.
Mm-hmm.
It'll always be Altman.
Yep.
The man speaks to me. Okay? I mean, you know, I know we take a look at Pauline Kael and we go, a lot of us. But she said something that I truly believe in. And that is when you first truly experience a film the first time, you connect to it so emotionally. And that was very true of The Long Goodbye. But even things like MASH, and which I had seen previously, and so on and so forth, I knew that Altman really, really meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. It's always Altman.
And here, before we get into, and this will be where we start to, after this question, we'll start to ask the other guests the questions again, but... what are your top five Altman? And let's do it Siskel and Ebert style. So from five to one.
Okay, so let me just get in front of, I had it set up here for a second.
Okay.
Okay. It's really hard for me to say in terms of 5-1. We all know what one is anyway. Okay. That's a good 5 California split. Okay.
That's a good one.
Four, I think, would be shortcuts. Okay. 3. Hold on here. 3 would be 3 women. Okay. 2, without a doubt, would be Secret Honor. And 1 is the Longer Bar. And that's today. Okay. That can change. Trust me.
Oh, yeah.
Adam.
Yep.
Was he the only person who didn't name McCabe and Mrs. Miller in his top 5?
Yes, he is.
Okay, just checking.
Yep.
You know, the thing about McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which I think is a really good film, I hate to say this. Well, no, I don't. The soundtrack grates on me. I'm not a Leonard Cohen fan.
Boo! Get on the tar feathers!
Amen, Carl. Amen. I do not like Leonard Cohen at all, but I do like that soundtrack. But I do not like Leonard Cohen in principle. And aside from that soundtrack, I can't stand him.
Well, let me put it this way. My former partner, Stephen Ronquillo, and Stephen loves Leonard Cohen. And he keeps trying. You know, Leonard Cohen is great when somebody else does his song. Great songwriter. Can't fucking sing worth a damn. And I'm sorry, I like singers. So that's me. But without the singer, Tanker would be in my top 5. Easily.
Yep.
Easily.
So now we come to the part where I'm going to start asking everyone else questions. Oh, excuse me. So, you know, this is the part I don't believe we got to last time because, well, fuck Blog Talk. But here is the first question, the one that I don't think we got to ask. And that is, if he has a flaw as a filmmaker, what is it? Patrick?
Oh, I don't. You know what? I don't know. I don't think I would know. Since he's my favorite filmmaker, it's hard for me to find fault with him. Even his body of work stands as one. It's got strong pieces. It's got some not so strong pieces. It's got some, you know, medium pieces. There's nothing that, I don't think he ever devolved. I don't think that he ever played it safe, except for maybe The Gingerbread Man being the one exception, I think, in late in his career that feels like a sort of more of a calculated move. But, you know, Robert Altman meant it. I mean, he was the true independent. He was a true maverick. I mean, the body of work tells a story of an artist that was fearless and went out perfectly. I mean, again, we talked about it last time, but, you know, when I got to A Prairie Home Companion this time around, it was doubly moving. And the way his story is told through his films, from his beginnings in Kansas City, which is where The Delinquents was made, where he beat John Cassavetes to the punch by 2 years by writing, producing, and directing, or writing and directing at least, the Delinquents as an independent film, which, by the way, influenced Herc Harvey in over in Kansas to make Carnival of Souls, which then influenced George Romero to make Night of the Living Dead in 68. You know, Altman at the very beginning was telling his story, and then to tell it the way he did all the way through his career to end on Prairie Home Companion, it's just such a beautiful package. I find no fault with any of it.
What about you, Aaron?
Well, I tend to agree. But when I look at, like, the handful of his films that just don't work for me, they don't work because they bore me. So I don't think he's boring, per se, but I do think that that leisurely pace that he gets that works so well most of the time, that when he loses track of it, that pacing becomes an issue. I think that there's just a handful of times where the leisureliness becomes nap-inducing for me. I don't think it's a flaw necessarily. I can't call it a flaw because when it's working right, very well. But I do think that it's one of those cases where one of his strengths ends up being used against him at times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Carl?
Well, okay, so you take a look at his films. I think the one thing you can say about some of his lesser films and the films that don't work is he loves to be diffuse. He loves these big canvases. But sometimes those big canvases become too big or not controlled enough. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of A Wedding, for example. Or on the opposite end, something that is so controlled that he can expand. Of course, you know, my worst film is a perfect example of that because it's so stage-based.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So it's that sense. It either gets too diffuse or too compact. And he has to find the middle ground, which he does 90% of the time. But there is that 10%. And there is that 10%.
Yep.
So that's what I would say. I would say the diffusion, if it's not controlled enough, that it can be detrimental.
Yep. So now I'm going to go to Aaron and ask him this question. Who is his most important collaborator?
Didn't we do this one?
I want to go over it one more time because, as I recall, a couple of us weren't quite sure if we had our final pick that night. So I want to give everybody a chance to kind of have a final say on who we think his most important collaborator is.
Oh, I'm sticking with mine. I think his children absolutely are his most important collaborators. And specifically, let me double check the name. I believe it's Stephen Altman, who was his production. Yeah, Stephen Altman, was his production designer for basically the second half of his career. And they'd worked together before that, but it was every film, starting sometime in the 80s. And his production design just was so wonderful, especially in stuff like Gosford Park. But he loves to let his camera meander, and so there has to always be something to look at, and it can. Steven's sets were always packed with things to look at, but never felt crowded. And so I do think that
Yeah, I think that Stephen Altman was his most important collaborator.
Mm-hmm. And I will ask Patrick now. Patrick, are you sticking with your choice from last time?
Yeah, I'm sticking with Scott Bushnell because he was just with him for such a long period of time, and I think it marked a really great creative period. He was with him during that you know, time in the wilderness in the 80s as a producer or a co-producer or an executive producer on every movie from Nashville to Kansas City. But also he was the costume designer on Quintet, Popeye, Come Back to the Five and Dime, Streamers, and Vincent and Theo. And he did the production design on O.C. and Stig. So he, you know, I think he worked really, really well with Altman. And I think that when he left, the first movie that Altman did after he left was The Gingerbread Man. And I think that tear is still visible from a 10,000-foot view.
Yeah. So finally to you, Carl.
Well, I think everybody takes a look at who worked with him. But I want to take a look at one of his protégés, because the interesting thing about the 70s and the 80s is that even if Altman wasn't directing the film, Altman was, and that, or at least his protégé. And I've got to say Alan Rudolph. I think Alan Rudolph, who worked as a production assistant,
yeah,
starting with his film in 69, I think, and then worked with him all through the 70s. And then he did Welcome to L.A. on his own with Altman producing that film, and Remember My Name and Choose Me. Rudolph, who I also loved dearly as a director, I think the difference between Rudolph and Altman is that Altman was humanistic and Rudolph is really a romantic. And to see films like Choose Me, which is not an Altman film but has so much DNA, I just love it. And to me, I think Rudolph is the one protege that really came into his own. So I'd say Alan Rudolph.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something I was thinking. You know, I've talked to all three of you about Altman over the past few weeks, and I know you keep calling him a humanist, but I know Aaron looks at him quite differently. So Aaron, how would you look at Altman?
I think of Altman as a postmodern stylist. I think that he likes to tinker with genres. I think that he likes to deconstruct them and put them back together in his own unique vision and see how they work and what makes them tick. I think that his best films explore genres as much, if not more so, than characters. And I do think that he does look at the human animal from all angles, but I think ultimately that his fascination is with genre more than anything. I think he's very much a stylist.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. And then
I was going to say, before we let Carl have a comment on that, I was going to ask Patrick, how do you see Altman in terms of this? Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I mean I see both. I more classify him, you know, as a humanist, but I also agree with with Aaron that he also is much into deconstruction of genre. But you know, what I also don't know, I think that his style was so palpable and interesting that I think that it's what I think it was so stylized, and I think that other filmmakers kind of aped it. And I think, like Steven Spielberg, for example, I think Steven Spielberg's initial magic was to take an Altman scenario. And if you ever watch Jaws, before the shark comes in, all of that shit feels so much like an Altman film on an island. And Close Encounters, too, where it's just a bunch of busy shit. He put Altman, he put people in Altman situations and made fantastic stuff happen to them. And that was sort of that's why people sort of like glommed on to Steven Spielberg, I think, because they recognized those kinds of people and those kinds of scenarios and the kind of middle classness of it all. And how the busy template was, you know, I think kind of invented by Robert Altman in a way. But I think he found a real warmth in just normal people doing normal stuff. And I think that's what really comes through in his films. And I think that's why they stay with us. I forget about him being a genre deconstructionist myself when I'm watching his stuff. I really do. But I do recognize that that's what he is doing.
Mm-hmm. excuse me. So, yeah, Carl, it seemed like you were about to have a response to what Aaron said, so please go ahead.
Aaron. So what I would say to Aaron is I agree with you, okay? But I wouldn't just say it was genre. I mean, my favorite film, I'm going to mention it again, Well, Goodbye, God knows that deconstructs everything.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and he did that. He deconstructed art. Okay, and I'll explain that in a second. He loved performance. He loved art. And so you get something like The Company, which takes a ballet company and he just like lays it bare. His music, we talked about his TV work. What we didn't talk about was his documentaries for Great Performance. And how much he dug into music and what makes it tick for him and so on and so forth. He was very, very much, that was another part of him that I do connect with, maybe not as much in terms that I keep saying that he's a humanist, because that to me is his number one primary thing. But it's not just genre, it's everything he did, he deconstructed. So I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, like the music you mentioned, specifically in Nashville, it opens with such a takedown of the way that country music was going all patriotic there in the lead up to the bicentennial, and 200 years specifically is riffing on "Proud to Be an American," and just. It's hilarious in how brutal, but how also respectful of the original it is.
Well, it was amazing in those terms. I mentioned Company. You mentioned Nashville. I mean, we could go into Kansas City and how much he just made that music not only alive, but made it of its time. So it's like you're stepping back into time and all these things that he did. And we were talking about Tanner and his use of music there, which I think is just incredibly pertinent. That's what he did. Anything that he did, he was very, he loved improv, but it had to be controlled the way he wanted it. That man was a control freak. There's no doubt about it, but he let people be who they were.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've now come to the point of the show where I ask this question, and I will go to Patrick first. Patrick, is there anything that we have not covered, perhaps specifically about his TV work or Tanner 88 in specific that you would like to bring up before we get going?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I think we've covered, you know, pretty much everything that I can think of. There's nothing really that I feel we have not covered. But yeah, I mean, I when we were talking about Vincent and Theo and everybody was, you know, talking about how that's in their top 10, Tanner 88's in my top 10. I think it's just a wonderful piece, and
it is.
And I can't recommend it enough. Sort of separate from his other stuff, because you know it takes a bit to get through. It's you know long. It'll take you a day. But it's so worth it, and it's so smart. It's just, you know, it's wonderful. So,
yep. So, Carl, anything you want to say about Altman real quick, particularly, as I said, you know, Tanner TV work before we get going?
Not particularly. I think we've covered it. The one thing I might say Well, actually, no, I don't have anything. Never mind.
I think
we've covered it.
And Aaron?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Well, in that case, Carl, what do we have coming up on Deviant Legion?
Okay, so we've got, it is a new year. What I can tell you is this, we've got a show tomorrow, Rachel, down the rabbit hole. We're going to go back to our music shows, and we're going to do what, where, who, why, and when, and how songs with those words in the title. And trust me, I just put everything into the studio, or just about to, actually. And we got quite a selection for you. So that we're going to do on Saturday. That's at 8 o'clock. That's tomorrow. On Sunday, we are going to have our year-end show, and that is basically year in review 2021. And we have Brian Wallinger with us. We have John Killian is going to come with us, and filmmaker Joe Badon will be with us too, and that'll be on Sunday. And then we have upcoming shows. I can guarantee you that at one point or another, we're going to be doing a show on Betty White.
Yep. Sooner than later.
And we'll also do a show on, or maybe a commentary watch of a Sidney Poitier film. I can also tell you that on the 24th, which is a Monday, a very special memorial podcast. David Whittington of Incredibly Strange Films passed away right before Christmas. And he was not only a good friend, but somebody I worked with very, very closely for 2.5 years at ISF as his first co-admin. And so he passed away, and we are going to have a memorial podcast for David on the 24th. That is Monday, January 24th at 8 p.m. I can tell you this, that his aunt will be on, his niece, and a good friend, and we're going to have some people from ISF and people call in and just share your remembrances of David. It was a real shock to us that he passed. So that we're going to do on the 24th. So right now, that's what we have. I can guarantee you there will be more. I know that Donald Farmer will probably be joining us this month. Bruce Devlin will be joining us this month. Also in February, Keenan Walker is going to come back, and we're going to be working with Keenan on a number of black themed things for Black History Month. And so we're getting ready to really move here, guys. So just keep with us at Deviant Legion, and we'll keep you entertained and informed, and hopefully you'll enjoy everything you hear. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I got.
Well, my own show, Cathode Ray Mission, will be back next week with an episode on the HBO miniseries Watchmen, which I found to be a rather extraordinary look at race and quite a bit more. We've had a lot of shows the last few years that deal with the Tulsa Massacre, but this may be the one that I think is the most cogent, and the one that I also think might be the greatest artistic achievement of the three or four works that have come out over the last year and a half, 2 years on television that deal with that horrible, horrible occurrence. And I think it's going to be worth speaking about. We will be having a couple of really good guests next week. I think we'll always have good guests, but the following week, on the 21st, we will be doing an episode on director Billy Wilder, featuring special guest Joseph McBride, who has recently had a book called Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, published. And he will be coming in, speaking a little bit about his book, but also answering a whole range of questions about Wilder. Now, for those of you who have been listening to the show a while, you might go, wait, didn't you do a Wilder episode a while back? Yeah, we did. May of 2020, we did an episode. But that was more looking at the films, film by film, and discussing it in a different way. This episode, we're going to look at Wilder's career. We're going to look at themes and kind of do a more critical study of his work. So this will be different than what we did nearly two years ago, and that's one of the reasons that I wanted to do it. I didn't have the opportunity to have Joe as a guest, and he's been on the show before for the Spielberg episode. Wonderful, wonderful historian and writer, and looking quite forward to hearing from him and getting into Wilder, I think, in a more meaningful way. We had lots of fun last time, but when you're trying to discuss 26 films in a 2.5, 3-hour episode, you can't really go too much in depth. And this episode, I think, will allow us to do a little more depth. So that's what we're going to be doing. So, anything past that, well, I don't want to spoil it, but we do have a couple of episodes in the works that I think you listeners will have fun with, including, yes, we are. Watchmen is not going to be the last science fiction or fantasy-tinged episode coming up over the next couple months. We've got some stuff in store that I think will be right in the Deviant Legion wheelhouse. So with that, I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank you guys for coming in and participating as guests. Thank you for being here. And I think that'll be a wrap, guys. That'll do it. So on the count of three, we can say goodnight. And I will see you guys next week. And hopefully, you listeners out there, please come listen. Watchmen's a great show. If you haven't seen it, tune in. If you have, please tune in. So, one, two, three, good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.